Hi, everybody. Welcome back. This will be the last. All right, thanks. This will be the last sort of content lecture. Wednesday, I'll be doing a review. We'll go over the sample final. We'll go over the problems on that. So definitely, please come. Please bring questions, because the actual final will have exactly the same format, and the justifications will be exactly the same. So you really should try to make sure you know that. What else? If you do have questions that you wanted to ask now, I can field a couple now, but there's a bunch of things I'm going to try to get through, so I won't force you to ask questions. All right. So let's see. So what else? The sample final is out. If you have questions, right, we'll go over it Wednesday. I did get one of the students in the class, Victor Wong, after the lecture on last Wednesday. We talked about a little bit about machine learning and about getting computers to take lots and lots of data and find interesting things and answer questions for you. He sent me a really interesting article from the New York Times Magazine on what's called collaborative filtering, which is basically the problem of if you have a whole lot of people who've told you what they like and what they don't like, and then a new person comes by and says, well, I like this and this, but not that, can you predict what they will like and dislike from other objects in the set? This turns out to be really important for recommending music to people. Netflix uses it to recommend movies to people. Amazon uses it, at least in part, to recommend products for people to buy. And they claim that this, you know, millions of dollars of their income comes from making good recommendations at the right time to the right person. And the way that they do this is all with clever machine learning techniques. The Netflix in particular made a whole lot of their data available for scientists and hobbyists to play with, and they said, we'll offer $1 million to anybody who can do 10% better than our recommendation system. And over the last maybe year and a half, groups have been trying to do that. They've been getting better and better and better. They're up to something like 9.6% better than Netflix's old algorithm. And they're more or less stalling at this point. It seems like they've more or less hit the limit of what they can do. And this article claims that the reason is it's movies like Napoleon Dynamite, which seem to be completely impossible to predict. Doesn't matter what you've liked in the past. Whether you like Napoleon Dynamite or not seems to be, you're either going to like it or love it, and we have no way to know which one it is. So they've been having a lot of trouble with a handful of movies like that that are causing a lot of their error. But anyway, it was a nice, if you do get a chance to read this article, it is a really nice presentation of what people are doing in machine learning, at least for this problem, and why it has some impact, and why it's challenging. So I thought that was pretty cool. All right, I'm going to ask two quicker questions, I think. And this one in particular is closely related to one that's on the final and the sample final, so I thought it would be good to have a chance for us to talk about it in class, in case you had questions and so forth. So I think I might have put this up on the screen at the very end of the lecture last time, but this is sort of what a scratch program might look like to run a thermostat in a house. So what is this actually doing? It says when you turn on the thermostat, so when thermostat clicks, you turn it on, and what it does is it runs a forever loop. A forever loop says just keep doing the items in this block over and over again, with never ending. Now, usually, we would think of a forever loop as being a bug in a program, right? If you're trying to compute something and it runs forever, then you'll never get the answer. But in fact, for things like thermostats, this is actually a really useful thing because you'd like the thermostat to keep doing its job arbitrarily long. So what the forever loop says is, in the beginning of the loop, it says, okay, set temperature. So the temperature is a variable. Set it to a sensor value. So we've got a sensor out in the world that's actually measuring the temperature. We can take the value of that sensor and assign it to the variable temperature. So the variable temperature now holds what the current temperature in the room is. Then we hit an if statement. It says, if the temperature in the room that we just measured is colder than the setting, so we have, you know, there's a variable setting that somebody set, either with a little knob or hardwired into the machinery, whatever it is, there's some value of the target temperature and there's some value of the current temperature. If the current temperature is too low, it's less than what the thermostat set for, then it runs the activate heat, basically turns on the heat for a minute. When that's done, we go back up to the top of the forever loop and it just keeps doing this over and over again. Every minute it says, is it too cold? If it's too cold, turn on the heat for a bit. The end of that, is it still too cold? If it is, we'll turn on the heat for a bit. Is it cold now? No, it's okay now. What about now? No, it's still okay. What about now? Still okay. What about now? Now it's too cold. Okay, turn on the heat for a minute. So it's all this does all day long. It just sits there and just runs in that loop, turning on the heat for a minute each time it notices the temperature drop too low. Okay? So this is a correct version of the thermostat program. I'm going to show you several incorrect versions, and you need to describe what will it do that's wrong. Okay? So here is a wrong thermostat program. Okay, this one has a bug. So what does it always do? A, turns on the heat when it's hot. That would be a problem, right? If it's too hot out and then it turns on the heat, that would be a bummer. B, it turns on the heat at most once. So, you know, one time it gets cold, it turns on the heat, but then never turns on the heat again. That would also be a problem. C is leaves the heat always on or always off, which says in the beginning, if it's too hot, it turns the heat off and never turns it on again. In the beginning, if it's too cold, it turns the heat on and leaves it on forever. That would also be a bad behavior for a thermostat. Choice D is it turns off the heat at most once. So the heat is running, keeping the house nice and warm, and eventually the house is warm enough, it turns off the heat, but never turns it off a second time. So that would also be bad. And then E, never turns on the heat no matter what. That would also be bad, especially in days like today. My hand is still chilly. I didn't go outside to come from my office. And I ran a 10K yesterday, which was cool, but it was very, very cold.
The wind.
Okay, all right, so that's the description. So then I'll read the script to you. When the thermostat's turned on, it starts a forever loop. It sets the temperature variable to be whatever the temperature sensor says. If temperature greater than setting, it broadcasts activate heat and wakes, and then it's back into the loop. So what does this do that's wrong? Fuzzy and you can't read it, let me know. Is it readable? Well, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, stopping. All right, so there's lots of things that we could have done wrong here. We might have not used a forever loop. If we didn't use a forever loop, lots of bad things can happen in terms of it, you know, turning on the heat once but never again. In this case, it looks like what happens is it measures the temperature, and if the temperature is higher than the setting, in other words, it's, you know, the current temperature is like 90 degrees and we have the thermostat set for 75 degrees, then it turns on the heat, which is exactly backwards from what it should do. That greater than there should be a less than. So what this will do is it will turn on the heat when it's too hot, which is backwards from what you'd really want. And the good news is, you guys are getting better at this stuff. 62% of the class agreed with me, which is good. All right. Just so you know, the one on the sample final and on the real final, I mess with the loop a lot. So you just make sure to check that it really says forever if it needs to run forever. I think that's it for clickers, and not just for this lecture, but like that's it for everything. Yes.
I said C. Uh-huh. If it is too hot, the heat will turn on and it will always remain.
Right, so this is why I put the always in parentheses here. So you're right that in practice, probably what will happen is once it gets too hot, it'll turn on the heat and it'll never get cold again, right? Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah.
But that's not necessary.
It'll never turn on. So it'll be forever hot.
Right, but that's not necessarily true because the world changes temperature, right? So when summertime comes, the temperature will change and the values will change. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, don't think about it like just today, just right now. Yeah, yeah. No, so it's a good point that you picked that up because describing what it would do when you actually deployed it is one thing, but trying to, you know, in the abstract, what does this actually do that's wrong? The temperature can go on and off if the outside temperature of the world changes drastically enough. And we don't have direct control over that. All we can do is turn on the heat and hope for the best. So. All right, very good. Interestingly, anybody notice the slide number, the last slide of the of all the clicker questions? The power of two.
That's awesome. All
right. My number, I ran this 10K with my sister yesterday, and the number, my little number was 1284, and so my sister handed it to me because we ran it near her house. And I said, oh, all the digits are powers of two. She said, yeah, that's just what I thought. All right, all right, I get it. All right, so we left off last time. We talked a little bit about these forever loops being a useful thing for stuff like thermostats and operating systems and video games, things that are out in the world interacting over a long period of time. One of the coolest things that are like that, in my opinion, are robots. So I'm going to quickly summarize a bunch of ways that people have used robots. Why? What do robots have to do with computer science? Well, basically these days, robots are basically computers with arms and legs, or wheels, right? They're basically, all the stuff that goes on in them is software. It's all computer controlled, but instead of having a keyboard and a screen, they're attached to sensors and effectors, things that can learn about what's going on in the world and things that can have some impact on the world. But inside, the whole brain part is all just programs. There's lots of different kinds of robots that people have built over the years, and they have very different kinds of purposes. So let me just summarize what some of those are. So manufacturing robots are often arms and little else. Sometimes they don't even have eyes. They just repeat the same series of motions over and over again. They're useful for part sorting or painting cars, basically very repeatable actions. They can be much more precise and reliable and tireless compared to people. So they've proven very, very useful in large-scale manufacturing. There's another class of robots which has basically just been for fun, for research, for learning, and for hobbies. So you can see a couple of these up here right now. This is the upper left corner is the original MIT Handy Board, which eventually became the Lego Mindstorm robots, which they're now in version 2. This is the Mindstorms NXT robot set. It's really cool, and I one of the things I do is I volunteer at the local middle school, and they have a little robotics club there, and they build all kinds of cool stuff, and these kids are very creative. And so these robots are a really valuable way for people to be thinking about software and its interaction with the physical world, things that you can actually touch and grab and make death machines out of. That's what a lot of them seem to do. The one above the Mindstorms robot is a bunch of robots from a company called Pioneer that makes robots for research labs of various sizes and shapes. The one on the top row between that with the umbrella on it, does anybody know what that is? Can you recognize it just from the picture? You might not know it as a robot. It's usually not a robot. Look underneath all the stuff, yes. It's a Segway. You know, these Segways, these two-wheeled contraptions, you stand on them, you lean a little bit, and it goes... So people have noticed that they're really very, they get around much better than, say, tiny little wheeled robots. They can go up over curves, they can go really fast. So people took out the seat and just put in a laptop and connected it up to the control system of the Segway, and they can drive it around. They had a team of these actually playing soccer against people on Segways. So it was a robot against human soccer match where people would be on Segways, they had a little button that made a flipper go so they could kick the ball, just to make it a little more fair. And the other team was Segways that had cameras that were trying to find the ball, and they would go to the right place and they'd activate their little flippers. It's pretty neat. Okay, how about this? Does anybody know this robot? This was in the news a lot, maybe a year or 2 years ago. This is was named Stanley. This is a robot. It's actually a Volkswagen Touareg, I think. But it's instead of a driver's seat, there's a computer, and instead of a steering wheel, there's USB wire going into the steering wheel. And lots of other sensors actually sitting on the top of the car. And it drove 200 miles across the desert at an average of about 30 miles per hour. And it beat a whole bunch of other cars that were trying to do the same thing. And the team that built this out of Stanford won $1 million for winning this. It was called the DARPA Grand Challenge. So this is a robot that was really just built as a research platform. But you know, it had a big impact. It made a big splash in the news. And it now, it's sort of been put out to stud in a sense that they actually, Volkswagen, who gave them the car, the researchers the car, they took the car back and they actually now parade it through all sorts of car shows in Germany. Some robots have been used for space exploration. You're probably familiar with some of these guys. in addition to the ones that actually kind of prowled around on Mars that were all remote controlled, there's a person sitting on Earth with a joystick and an incredible network lag between the robot that was sitting on the surface of Mars and the humans on Earth. You know, you say, okay, go forward, and it's something like 15 minutes before that command is received and the information comes back. So it's really irritating. It would be nicer if that was a full-fledged autonomous robot, but they haven't deployed that yet. They did. So the NASA scientists are very, very conservative. They don't let people like me control any of their stuff. But they did very briefly. They had the Deep Space Agent. It was a probe hurtling through the solar system, headed toward the outer limits. And it had the standard NASA software running it, but they actually were able to flip over to a piece of software that was running artificial intelligence design stuff. And it very briefly controlled the Deep Space probe while it was flying out. So that was pretty cool, an example of people who I know putting their software on something that's actually flying through space. There is now a set of robots that are actually sold for people to use in their home, not to play with and not to experiment with, but actually to help in various ways, like the Roomba, which does vacuuming. There's robot lawnmowers, which scares me. This is Scuba, I think it's called, or Scoomba or something like that. That's a mopper in the top, which actually seems like a really useful thing. Very big in Japan. The Japanese are very comfortable with the idea of robots inside their homes helping in various ways. It's a Japanese nurse bot in yellow there. And there's teams of researchers in the U.S. who also are very interested in these kind of home care problems that come up when you put robots helping the elderly.
What's your name?
Robin Murphy. So that's Robin Murphy, the only person who I've ever gone to a scientific talk, and actually cried, because she... She said some of her robots actually helped in the rescue operations, or they ended up not being rescue operations, when the World Trade Center went down. So her robots were actually there in the rubble trying to find survivors. And she just explained it in vivid detail. And the robots were really important to all this, but the human element is just extremely compelling. So those are some of the things that people have done, you know, helping people who are not robotics people or manufacturing people, but people. Then there's these sort of robots that have been used. They're designed for use in the home, but they don't really have any purpose other than to just hang out and be, you know, your friend. And this is the Sony Aibo robot. This is the last generation of Aibo before they stopped making them. So at some point, Sony decided that it wasn't lucrative enough, and they stopped making them. But before they went away, we got a couple in our lab. So I'm gonna turn things over to Kashyap for a second. He's gonna actually demo one of our Sony Aibos in a project he's been working on this semester. Sure, wherever you're comfortable. Probably if you can do it up on the table, then people can see better. But okay. If you have to do it on the carpet,
I can do it on the.
Okay. All right. Do you want me to do an intro, or do you have stuff to say?
Okay, why don't you go ahead?
All right. So this robot is, like I said, it's basically a computer with arms and legs and dangly ears. It runs off a video camera battery that gets shoved into its gut. It's got a wireless card that slips into another orifice that I won't mention. It has a memory stick so that you can download programs onto it. It's got several buttons on its back so it can know when it's being pet. And it's got a LED readout on its face. Each arm has, I think, two or three separate motors that can be controlled through software. So instead of saying, you know, say hello and have it appear on the screen, you can basically say, set the joint angle to 45, and it goes bzzz, and it goes to that position. And because of that, because you can coordinate the motions, you can make it walk, you can make it sit, you can make it stand up. And what Kashyap's going to demonstrate is coordination with the camera. It actually, the very tip of its nose is a little CCD camera, like the kind of camera that you get in a digital camera. And it can actually see out into the world. It doesn't know what it's seeing very well, but what Kashyap did is he gave it a little bit of software. Do you want this out of the way?
Yeah.
Okay. A little bit of software that allows it to detect things of a particular bright shade of color. Which, as long as I don't show the robot, I can show it to you. All right, so the robot actually goes through its camera image. You remember we talked last time about what is a digital image? It's actually a whole bunch of triples of numbers that specify the color at each position on the pixel. Well, this color doesn't occur naturally in nature. So Kashyap was able to figure out what color this was, how the robot perceived it, and had it actually scan through to find in the image, do you see anything with that triple of numbers or close enough to that triple of numbers? So it could detect when it, when the ball is around. Actually, not so different from the green screen program, where it had to find that shade of green. The robot is running a thing finding this shade of red.
Something's not working.
That's the thing about demos. Do you need to reboot it, or?
I just tried rebooting it now, so.
All right, so maybe it'll come back.
Yeah.
All right, I'll keep stalling. So while this is booting, actually, why don't I do the next slide or two? And we'll come back to that. There's a whole industry apparently for white-legged robots in Japan. These are made by three different companies in Japan, specifically just to show off how cool the companies were. These robots weren't sold, they weren't mass manufactured, but they did cool things. So this is the Toyota robot actually had robotic lips. I'm not sure why they were in the market for creating robots with robotic lips, but nevertheless it could play trumpet. Like, it was literally playing the trumpet. It wasn't just holding it in place like that silly walrus. I've got nothing against German walruses. All right, so up in the upper right is the Sony Curio, which was a small two-legged robot that could move very smoothly. It was based on the same motor technology as the Aibo, and we were all us researchers were waiting desperately for them to make these available for sale, but they pulled the plug, so we never got to have them. But that one's doing a fan dance, because, you know, it's Japanese. These are the Honda Asimo robots, which are two-legged robots that could actually walk, and they could see to some degree, and they're actually playing a very, very lame game of soccer. But it's not that it's not how good they play, it's that they play at all. So the fact that they could actually walk around, kick the ball, and very slowly try to block the ball was it's a remarkable achievement. There's a group of people who have put together, actually it started in Japan as well, a thing called RoboCop. Has anybody ever seen any of this stuff on the news about that? Where people build robots and they play soccer against each other. And the goal, when they originally created this, was to have a team that could beat the World Cup human team by the year 2050. They're not anywhere near that yet. Some of these guys actually play pretty well, but not better than a person, not even better than a six-year-old. And in fact, they play a lot like six-year-olds. If you've ever watched six-year-olds play soccer, they tend to see where the ball is. Everybody sees the ball, and they have a little piece of code in their head that says, go to where the ball is, and so you get this sort of swarming effect. And often the robots will do exactly that. It took them about 3 years before they could teach the robots, just, you know, yes, 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 the ball is there, yes. But you need to be over here, because that ball is going to be there short, soon. So their gameplay has actually gradually increased. So what is it that makes these things different from computers? It's the fact that they have sensors and effectors that are under software control. Sensors include things like bump sensors. The Roomba has this little spring-activated bump sensor, so it knows if it hits something. Infrared, it can detect... infrared is often used as another kind of obstacle detector. It shines out infrared light, which we can't see, but they can build sensors that can see it and see if it comes reflecting back. And if it does, then it knows that there's something in the way to reflect off of. Vision sensors like cameras to see, light sensors just to know whether or not the level of light is high or low. Sonar sensors send out a pulse of sound and then listen back for the echo, which again is a way of doing obstacle detection. And you can sort of tell how far an obstacle is too by listening for the delay. Any hope that this is going to work?
Let me try the other one. Back up. I'll just bring the other one.
Okay, great. And sound sensors as well. So this robot in particular, and you can do this in Scratch too. I have some nice Scratch programs that actually listen for the microphone. Just is the sound level above a certain volume? If so, you can then trigger some behavior. So those are on the sensing side. On the acting side, you've got things like motors, lights that can get turned on and off, sounds. You can hear the robot was making some beeping sounds. There could be a graphical display like a screen, a laser. Though usually lasers are used as input devices, believe it or not. So a lot of robots like the car robot, the desert car robot that I mentioned before, has a laser mounted on the top of it. Not to keep it safe from desert animals or anything like that, but actually it scans, it shines the laser in a straight line across the field in front of it, and when the image of that laser bumps up or down, it tells the distance. So lasers are often used as a kind of active sensing. It shines the laser out and it gets depth information back. If we didn't have a live demo, which we may not have a live demo, then I was going to tell you a little bit about a project that an undergrad did for me a couple years ago here at Rutgers, where he had the Aibo could actually recognize a couple words of English just as individual words, like hello was word one, and if it ever heard the word hello, a particular memory location would turn to a one. It recognized don't do that, sit, stand up, lie down, shake paw. So the hardware itself came with these things built in. We didn't have to build them in. But we decided how we were going to interpret those for behavior. And what we did is whenever it heard one of these commands, it would try one of its actions. It has a set of things that it can do. And if it did the wrong thing, then we would say, don't do that. Which the program inside the robot interpreted as, oh, whenever I hear that word, I shouldn't do that action, I should try one of the other ones. On the other hand, if we say, I guess you don't say good Ibo, or something like that. Actually, if you said good Ibo, it would ignore you. But if you said bad Ibo, if you said don't do that, then it would say, okay, in the future, I'll try something other than that. So little by little, we say shake paw, and it sits down. You say don't do that. Oh, okay. Next time we say shake paw, it walks a little bit. No, don't do that. Then one time we say shake paw, it actually puts up its paw to shake. So we say good Ibo, but it doesn't care. All it knows is, oh, this one didn't get me punished, so I'm going to do that again in the future. So you can actually slowly train it to respond to these different commands just by having it change behavior if it's told that it's wrong and keep its same behavior if it's told that it's right. So it was very simple programming, actually, but it had this very nice effect. It made the robot kind of become the kind of robot we wanted it to become, at least in this simple domain. All right, so this is a video of the Honda Azimo actually walking around with this extremely irritating young woman. I saw this demo live in Pittsburgh a couple years ago. It's really amazing. It looks like a little dude in a suit, doesn't it? It's incredible.
It definitely is.
It's totally a robot. It's really amazing. I had my picture taken with it. It was pretty neat.
Did you sign an autograph?
No, because it's a robot. But it walks backwards and it can shake its hands around. It was really quite remarkable. The thing that was amazing to me, I think I have a shot of this too. They claim they built it in 99, building on 13 years of engineering experience, most advanced humanoid robot ever, walks about 1 mile per hour. When I was there in Pittsburgh, there was a buffet after the performance, and all this, people like me, the computer science, recognizably computer science-y people, were at the buffet getting their food, and there was this guy who just did not look like the rest of us. Sort of tall, shaggy hair, just didn't look, dressed differently. And I'm like, hi, what are you doing here? Because he seemed out of place. He said, I'm a puppeteer. Hi, what are you doing here? He's like, I stand behind the screen and I tell the Azimo what to do. He's got, and I found a picture on the web, he's got a Sony PlayStation controller. And he sits and he watches a video feed directly from the camera in the robot's head. So the robot's moving, doing its thing, projecting images backstage where a guy with a controller says, okay, we're going left a little bit, okay, we're stopping, we're going to stand on one foot. We're going to press BX trigger. I don't know what he was doing, but it was making the robot do what it was doing. There was no brain in that robot. All it was is a brain stem that was in charge of balance. So he wasn't actually making it balance, which turns out to be really hard to do. That was being taken care of by the robot. But all the decisions about, where to walk, when to walk, how to walk up the steps and so forth, that was all a dude. It wasn't the robot at all. And so there's a sort of sense that I had of being completely cheated at that point. Like, yes, it's a very impressive physical device, but there's no software. The software was in a human. It wasn't in the robot. So I had, when I got home, I had my kids, they're older now, but at that point, reenact the same video, walking backwards, waving their hands. I lost control at one point. So Molly, in particular, was the same age as the Azimo when I took this video. She also began development in 1999. She could walk up and down uneven terrain. She wasn't the most advanced anything. She was just an average kid. But she's dynamically stable. So, yeah, it's, unlike the robot, you can't stand behind with the joystick and actually have them follow your commands. But here, this is interesting to me. They're not particularly coordinated, but look at how cool that is. They're completely off balance the whole time that they're running in a circle. The Azimo can't do that. It actually adopts a walk. As cool as the walk is statically stable. The walk is like this, which looks kind of cool. But the fact of the matter is, if the robot had a software failure at any point, it would not fall down because its center of gravity was always in the range of its feet. It had these big honking feet, and it would always stay, keep its center of gravity over where its feet were placed. People don't walk like that at all. People are, you know, all over the place. And you don't have to teach them to do it. They just naturally do it, I found out. So this is a really big thing. What is it that's different between computers and robots, or these robots and people that allow these things to be very, very different? There has been some work in... So maybe walking's just too hard. We have all kinds of evolutionary history. What about crawling? So these are old IBOs. That at the University of Texas, a colleague of mine, Peter Stone, had them walking back and forth across a RoboCup soccer field. You can see they're wearing their little red soccer uniforms, actually. And using their camera to keep track of where they were and how far they were from the edge of the field. And they're just walking back and forth. But each time they walk back and forth, they change their walk a little bit and see what happens. So they're actually systematically learning over time how to walk faster. Because they can find out, oh, when I walk this way, you know, I put a little bit more stride into it, I get to the goal faster. When I walk, you know, with my knees up a little bit, that takes slower, I won't do that anymore. It can actually train itself over time to walk fast. And in fact, by the time they were done this little experiment, they had the fastest IBO gait ever developed. So one way that typical robots and human beings and animals are very, very different is that humans can always be tuning themselves to behave better over time. And now we're coming up with ways of teaching robots and computers to be like that, to watch their own behavior and do better. I couldn't resist, though. I have a different video of this. No, I'll play this one. Crawling, the robots crawling is pretty cool, but actually people crawling is even cooler. So I've been collecting, and if you have any videos to send me, please do. Videos of babies getting from one place to another using very different kinds of crawl. So this is my nephew, Reese, who is crawling in the sort of the standard style. He wasn't very good at it, but that was the very first time he had ever crawled, so that's pretty impressive. This is a friend of mine from college's second son, who came up with a way of crawling like that, because he didn't like getting his knees on the ground. So he had his own little gait that he developed. Another one of my nephews, Cameron, didn't like asymmetry. And he came up with this way of getting from place to place. It's almost like the butterfly. Nobody told him to do that. He didn't witness it anywhere. He invented this on his own. This is the brother of the one who did the bear claw crawl. Also had surgery on his hand and couldn't put weight on his wrist and came up with this. He would actually get around the house sliding on his butt, which, you know, if you're not the one buying the diaper, is actually a very efficient way of getting around. But it does terrible damage to the back of your pants. But it also leaves your hand free, right? So he skitters around and he's carrying stuff. The other kids can't do that. So that's pretty neat. This is another colleague of mine, Charles Isbell. His daughter didn't crawl. She actually rolled from place to place, which is brilliant because it's a lot energy-wise. It's a lot easier to get started. The problem is that. But the problem is because of round-off error, you could actually, and I mean round-off in this sense, you could be when you're back in position to grab, you may have actually missed your target. Whereas crawling, you know, you can get as close as you want. With the rolling, you can actually miss it, and that's what happened to her. So I've been collecting these, and the reason that I collect these is, what's cool about this to me is that babies actually are creatively inventing their own form of locomotion. And, you know, the robots, as cool as they are, we've generally had to tell them exactly how to move their limbs. They don't come up with that on their own. They don't, why? Because they don't care. Babies actually care. And if I replayed this for you again from the beginning, you'd notice that in every single one of the instances, the kids were all crawling to something. They weren't just crawling because they wanted to show off their crawl. They were crawling because they had a target in mind. To the extent that you can give robots and computers a target, there might be some hope of getting them to come up with stuff on their own and improve themselves over time. So, in fact, what I do in my own research lab is we try to create smarter machines, not by programming, telling them exactly what to do, which is like, you know, give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day, not even by programming by demonstration or supervised learning, which says, I'll show you what to do and you can just copy me, like teach a man to fish and he will fish for a lifetime. We do basically programming by motivation. We make the programs want something, which is we call this reinforcement learning. That's what the field is known as, which is not telling them what to do, but telling them what to want. What is it that they would like to accomplish? When should they feel happy? And that's kind of like, you don't teach a man to fish, you basically say, you like fish. Now figure out the rest on your own. And in fact, if suddenly, you know, the technology changes or fish sprout wings or something like that, what you learned when you learned how to fish might not work anymore, but the fact that you still want to catch those fish means that you're going to come up with a new way of catching them. So that's basically, at least at a high level, the sorts of things that we try to do. Here's an example of an IBO that we programmed in this way. We programmed it to want to see the pink ball. And all it can do is turn left or right based on what it sees out of its camera. And it starts off very clueless, just kind of turning around and around. But eventually, it sees the pink ball, and it gets a, you know, a little plus one. When it's not seeing the pink ball, it gets a zero. It's like binary. And over time, we just, you know, it should try to adopt those behaviors that get them more ones. You know, it has a natural love of ones. And so what it eventually does, and you can see this in the video, is it's little by little, it starts to make more and more efficient attempts at turning to face the ball. Until finally, no matter where we started, what angle we started at, it just makes a, not a beeline, I guess, but just makes a direct pivot right to face the ball. And so that's a really simple example, but we do more complicated things about, you know, the robots having to go to a target or having to turn on a light or avoid a wiggling obstacle. There's lots of stuff like that that we've played with. So we basically break this into two problems, the reward function, which is what it wants, and then the planning, which is deciding, the learning about the world. When I do this, what happens? What gets me what I want? And then finally the planning, which says, okay, now that I know how the world works, which behaviors should I adopt that will actually get me to my goal? I'm not sure what that's supposed to be. This was the video that I was thinking of showing you. But this is on the website. You can check this out anytime. But it's basically I made a 1 minute version. I put the babies crawling together, and an example of the IBOs learning something sort of creative. But I don't think I'm going to show that right now. Another movie. It's hard not to show you this. So watch really carefully. There's a remote control helicopter in the middle of the field. It is now ascending upside down. It is now flying, which is, I guess, okay. Just kind of hovering. Then it's going to try something crazy. It did a split S, which apparently, just based on what I'm seeing here, it's climbing and then flipping and then falling and then flipping. And so it's doing this sort of sequences of flying slightly upside down. I don't know if you've flown a helicopter before, but they're very weird. It's very hard to control. It's certainly very hard to get them to fly upside down. You don't normally see that with people flying helicopters. But this is a smaller helicopter, and it's all completely controlled by reinforcement learning. So what happened is these researchers at Stanford had a human fly the helicopter for a little while the robot, or the computer software, watched it and learned what the motions of the stick tended to do to the robot, to the actual helicopter. It's all instrumented with GPS and so forth, so the computer is able to track exactly where the helicopter is. So it can detect, well, when I move, this kind of motion causes this kind of thing in the helicopter. Then, back at the lab, they process that information, they devise a model to be able to work with it, and then they give it a goal. They say, we want you to fly this kind of pattern, you have to figure out how to do it. The computer thinks for a while, it makes a plan, and then it actually runs it on the real helicopter, and it does all that crazy stuff. So that's one of the coolest reinforcement learning examples that I've seen. This is maybe one of the least cool, but I still really, really love it. So we have a reinforcement learner that's learning to play this game, Pitfall, which is an old Atari video game. And what it's doing is actually watching the screen and watching how things change on the screen as it issues joystick commands. And it eventually figures out, you know, that it is that guy, and that moving left makes that guy move left, unless there's something in the way, or unless there's a scorpion that stings it. Moves to the right unless there's a wall. Up usually does nothing unless it's next to this ladder thing, in which case it actually goes up. And eventually it pieces all these things together and builds a model of what everything's like. You can see it's actually kind of exploring a little bit. Oh, what happens when I jump out of the pit? What happens when I go into the pit? What happens when I squat on this log? It's actually losing points really quickly. What if I do it on this side? It's like rubbing its butt up against the log. But eventually it finishes that, and it takes all that information, and it says, okay, what's the fastest way off the screen? I go up to the pit, I jump it, I go over to the log, I jump it, and then I'm done, and I do a happy victory dance. So we have it learning to do this sort of stuff. again, from experience, we just give it the game, we process a little bit of the screen for it, and we say, see what you can figure out. So that's kind of what we were doing in a nutshell. If Kashyyyk comes back to show us the robot, we'll do that. But in the meantime, let me dive into Chapter 9 so I can get through a lot of that. I'd like to finish Chapter 9 today, which I could do, I think. And then that'll keep us completely clear on Wednesday for the review stuff. The plan for Wednesday is to basically, I'll summarize everything we talked about in the class, even if it's not on the final first, and I'll show you a little song that kind of sums everything up. And then I'll talk specifically about the questions that are on the sample final. We'll go over them, make sure you really get what's being asked and how to solve those problems. And then we should be good. I'm also willing to come in Monday and Tuesday of next week if anyone wants to have some kind of review session. I'm not sure what people's availability is, but I can either schedule something and see who comes, or if there's a particular time that works for you and you're really interested in coming, send me mail and I'll schedule around that. But I'm pretty open on Monday and Tuesday next week for answering questions. So the last chapter of Hillis' book is about genetic algorithms. Now, one of the reasons, this is not the most central topic in computer science. There's good reasons to include it in this intro. But the reason that Hillis included it in the book is because there's only a couple areas of computer science that he's made a real contribution to, and this is one of them.
Let's go about it in the system.
Oh.
It's not a delay back and forth.
You get off the fourth floor at once.
After class, we should all go up to the lab if you want to see the robot doing its thing. It's not going to be able to work here. So why is that for the system? Which system is that?
DICE.
Oh, so DICE is actually the one doing all the processing.
Let's go back.
You learn something each time you try to do a demo. Can you make it just like do its... Like if you take the memory stick out and it'll just do a little random thing?
Oh, yeah.
Just to... Because
people love robots.
All right. So the real demo that we have planned runs, but we have to be a little bit closer to the... So the brain of this robot is currently in my lab on the fourth floor. And the delay between what it sees and its ability to respond going all the way through the network. Imagine your nerve cells actually going all the way up to the fourth floor hill and back. It's too much of a delay, and the demo's not working. But you can see the robot actually physically acting. So it does this, you know, just like your computer boots up, the screen goes blank, the keyboard flashes, it kind of resets everything. It has a physical reset to make sure that it actually is standing on flat ground. All right, so what it's doing at the moment is sitting. All right, let's stand up or sit up. This is basically a screensaver. Just a series of random actions that it takes that are kind of cute, but don't serve any purpose. It's wiggling the ears. You can see it's flashing on the sides there. It also has stereo microphones. So one of the demos we did once was to have it approach a sound by hearing which side it was on and kind of moving towards it. What Kashyyyk was going to show is the ball, which is gone now, but the red ball, it could actually see where it is in the camera image, and then it can actually move towards it. If the ball, the center of the ball, the red pixels are more on the left than the right, it turns a little bit to the left. If there's more red pixels on the right than the left, it turns a little bit to the right. If it's centered, it's centered, and it starts moving forward. So the ball sits there on the table, and the robot will walk over to it. If you move the ball, it responds by following the ball. Yeah, I'm totally being upstaged.
That's the best it's going to do.
All right. Well, does it walk a little bit as part of the demo? We can just let it...
do its thing.
Let it hang out.
Yeah.
If anybody notices it about to jump off the table, please alert us. Otherwise, I'll just leave it on. Let it distract everybody for a bit. It's wagging its tail. It's just like a real dog with an LED in its tail. All right, so... So Danny Hillis worked on these genetic algorithm problems. It's very cool stuff. In some ways, it's some people call it the second best way to solve any problem. Because it doesn't solve anything well, but it solves everything at least partially well. Let's see, stuff about the brain. About frogs. Oh, so Hillis makes the following point, which I probably should make. Sit. Good eyebrow. All right. That was a coincidence. All right. So, Hillis makes the point that the brain has lots and lots of neurons in it. There's lots and lots of connections between neurons. It's incredibly weird and complicated and interconnected. There does seem to be some amount of specialization in terms of some areas of the brain seem to be specialized for processing certain kinds of language. Others seem to be in charge of certain kinds of emotions. But yet, the brain is actually pretty plastic. The functions can shift around. So we got to see this actually. My son was born, he was 1 pound at birth. And he ended up getting a little bit of brain damage as part of his early development. And he had some very specific deficits, things that he couldn't do well, like recognizing certain faces was very hard for him. But then now he's in high school, he somehow managed to rewire his own brain, and that seems to have all gone away. He seems to be completely normal, given that he's my son. And so that's really cool. So he had these clear deficits, and they seemed to have more or less vanished. And so I think part of the story there is that even though the brain has these specialized regions, it's also very flexible and plastic. It can actually adapt and change, especially if pieces of it are missing. So it doesn't really act like a computer. If you take the arithmetic processor out of your computer, it's not going to eventually learn how to add again. Right? It's just gone. That piece was specialized to that function. Everything else is specialized to its function. Once it's gone, it's gone. So Hillis says that it's really good because it lets human beings be able to design these billion component devices and mass manufacture them and make them available, and they do all sorts of cool things. But you occasionally get these weird problems. So this is an example. Hillis gives a bunch of his own examples you can see in the book, but this was one that caught my eye. The Segway, which I mentioned a little bit ago, was recalled for a little while because it had a software glitch that caused it occasionally to fall on its face when it was low in batteries. So instead of doing what it should have done, which is to say, hey, I'm low on batteries, it would go, hey, I'm low, look, and just throw you directly onto your face. And the manufacturers were saying that was probably not good. So when they traced this back, they didn't mean to build them that way. They knew that the thing was going to run out of batteries, and they knew there was a warning for it. But there was a little problem with the way that the software was written that caused that problem, that caused this falling on your face problem to not get caught. So this is just a video of someone falling on the Segway, which I thought was funny. It's only 6 seconds long. It takes longer than that to load. Yay! All right. So so Hillis gives some examples that are not quite as funny as that. So there was a radiation treatment machine that would overdose patients if the operator typed too fast. The person running the machine would have to give it some information. If they typed too fast, it would actually end up double dosing patients. People were getting very sick. The Patriot missile tracking system was measuring time in tenths of a second, which you can't really accurately represent in binary. So it would keep doing round-off error, which was fine. But once the machine had been running for a couple weeks, it would start to lose precision in its ability to shoot missiles because it just kept accruing all this round-off error in its notion of what time it was. The Mars Climate Orbiter was a spaceship that was actually lost on entry into the Martian atmosphere, and they didn't know why, and then they went back and looked at the software, and it turned out that some people who contributed software to the lander were measuring distances in feet, and some people were measuring distances in meters, but they were just numbers, 6, 6. And so when it put them together, it misestimated where the surface of the planet was, and it crashed. It's a bummer. We had a minor version of that yesterday at the 10K where my sister's boyfriend was reporting distances in kilometers to her, and she was expecting them in miles, so she thought the race was over, and she was only halfway done. So that was sort of a bummer. She did not actually blow up, but the Mars Climate Orbiter actually did. The Mars Polar Lander had something similar where, as it was lowering itself down to the surface, the landing gear fell into place like this, clunk, and the clunk was interpreted by the software as, hey, we hit the ground, and so it shut the engine off. The thing just went and crashed into the surface of Mars at 30 miles an hour and was destroyed. It's one of these things where, you know, I write software with bugs all the time, but usually I can just run it again. This is one of these things where the engineers were like, oh crap, that's the end of my career. I mean, there's nothing, they don't get a second chance to land on Mars. A similar thing happened where they converted a real number into an integer and caused the thing to actually crash in flight. So these are like minor software bugs that people could write any time that end up having these very, very bad impacts. And what Hillis says, I think there's lots of different things you could say here. One is that, you know, people should be watched more closely. But another one is, Hillis says, no, this is a problem with how engineering is done. We don't want to engineer things piecemeal and glue them together. We should engineer full systems, like nature does. And that's this idea of a genetic algorithm. So genetic algorithms, what you do is you have a complete solution and you evaluate it and you give it a score and you combine partial solutions together to get larger solutions. But you're always testing it on the full problem. So I can tell you a bit about the way that this actually works. Some of the cool things about this is that the terminology is all completely lifted from evolutionary biology. So it makes it sound considerably cooler than when you say things like, well, you have a bit vector. And you flip a coin. So no, it's so you talk about it as each solution, each bit vector is actually an individual, and the set of individuals that are trying to solve the problem is a population. The set size that people use maybe have 200 of these solutions when you're running simulations. The objective function that you're trying to solve, they call that the fitness. Just like in an animal can be fit or not fit. Higher objective function values sometimes are replicated to allow more search to proceed from these examples, which is basically asexual reproduction. So basically, if you find a solution that's really good, you make some copies of it, and you put them into the population. Meanwhile, killing off some of the solutions that didn't seem to be doing as well. Local search steps are mutations. So if you take a solution and you make a little change to it, that's kind of like mutating a genome, so they call it mutation. Optimization proceeds in a series of generations. You have a bunch of these, they reproduce to get the next generation, see how they do, they reproduce to get the next generation. You can also take two solutions and let them let combine pieces of them together, and that's basically sex, or wait, we'll call it crossover. So two partial answers to a problem can actually be, you know, mated, and they produce an offspring which maybe does well in the world or not. But the search is completely driven off these, like, these critters coming together, you know, hooking up and making new solutions, and they get tested out in the environment, and this just repeats over a number of generations. The fit individuals are allowed to reproduce, the unfit individuals don't. It's basically inspired by this notion of Darwinian natural selection, evolution. And in fact, it can solve all sorts of very challenging problems this way. The whole flow of it is something like this. You have the solutions are all encoded as little sequences of bits. Remember that you can encode anything in bits. So you have a population of those, you take an individual, you interpret it to make to see how they do in the world, you measure their fitness, and the ones that are more fit are reproduced and mutated and then mated to the next generation, and this loop just keeps going around and around. Each generation generates new individuals that get values, and over time this tends to produce more and more fit solutions, that is to say, better and better answers to the original problem that they were trying to solve. There's lots of questions that you have to answer when you actually write code to do this specifically, which I don't think I need to get into in a lot of detail. This is Python code that actually is a very simple genetic algorithm. But the cool thing about this, as far as the intro class is concerned, is to do this right, you need to really worry about loops, you need to worry about lists of things. When items are made to reproduce, they're all sorted. So every solution has a score. You put all those scores in order, and the ones that have high scores are allowed to reproduce, and the ones with low scores are asked to leave the simulation, killed. It basically has elements of graph search and hill climbing in it. You can define it as a formal problem. These run actually really well in parallel. You can take each individual solution and run it on a separate computer, let them all compute their fitnesses, and then there's the big, you know, sort of orgy step where they get together and make new solutions. And they're trying to optimize an objective function. So just like the local search stuff that I talked about briefly. So it draws on lots of the ideas that we've talked about over the course of the semester. Here's a really cool video where a guy was actually simultaneously evolving geometric shapes and behavior of those shapes to maximize a particular objective function, and then he'd simulate them to do fitness evaluations. So, and then he animates them to make us all entertained. So basically, these are it's a genetic algorithm that's searching the space of swimming blocks. And the score assigned to a block is basically how far can it swim per unit time. So he has a bunch of these. They all evaluated, and the good ones get mated to each other, and they make more and more sort of beautiful solutions to this particular problem. This is one of the coolest GA examples that I am familiar with. I mean, some of them look like critters, right? These could be tadpoles or something like that, right? Now all he has to do is change the objective function and say, now we're going to measure your fitness by how far you can move in one direction on a flat surface with gravity. So it learns sort of this weird rolling pattern, this kind of... Actually, that looks like my nephew Cameron. That's something entirely weird. Remember, it's not being told how to solve the problem. It's just being told, oh, you scored 3 on this problem. You scored 8. We're going to make more copies of the one that scored 8 and more variations of it. It's sort of otherworldly in a sense, right? He's like created this universe where these block critters really came to life. Oh, and by the way, all this is simulated on the connection machine that Danny Hillis designed. So it kind of comes back on that as well. So that's kind of a cool one. There's some of them actually took advantages of bugs in the simulation software. He had a bug that made it so that momentum was not conserved, so you could actually hit yourself on the back and propel yourself forward with that. So that was kind of neat. Jumping, right. How high? The fitness function was how high off the ground can you get? This one is how close to the target can you get? So there's a little target that the person's controlling. So they actually have to evolve to be pretty nimble about how they use the target to decide which direction to go. It would be better if it didn't have that third leg. And you can see it keeps targeting it. So that's pretty cool. So it's using the bottom propeller. The propeller that's farther away from the target is always using that. That's pretty neat. All right. So that was a while. This was in 1994. I haven't seen anything quite that cool since then. All right. So what I'd like to do. I think we're doing okay time-wise. One of the things that struck me as being interesting is the first time. One of the first research things that I worked on actually was genetic algorithms. And the first academic conference I went on when I was a young, naive researcher was a genetics algorithms conference. And I had never, had somebody fly me somewhere to present my ideas before. It was very exciting for me. So I was on the airplane flying to San Diego, I think. And guy sits next to me, big guy with a big cowboy hat. And I just wanted him to ask me where I was going because I wanted to tell somebody because I was so excited. And so I just, I kept kind of making eye contact and stuff. And eventually the guy seemed really, really nice. And eventually he took the bait and he asked me what I was doing and where I was going. And I told him all about this genetics algorithm project and how I was going to present it and giving him all the details about, and then you have to make sure the fitness function has this property. He couldn't care less, but he was so nice and he listened so patiently and he nodded along. And at the very end when I finally wound down, can imagine me talking a lot. When I finally went down, he nodded and looked at me and said, well, what if it turns out that evolution isn't real? And I did not expect that as the response. So it was a very interesting response to me because I guess I hadn't ever met anybody who would question the ideas of evolution before. But now, more and more of them are showing up on the news. So it is a real thing that happens and people have this particular perspective. But in this particular case, I was able to look him back in the eye and say, it doesn't change what the computer program did. In some sense, it didn't matter what was happening in biological evolution because we're just building software and the software behaved the way it did. Like, even if our real universe doesn't work that way, I know my software did because I built it that way. So it doesn't really prove anything one way or the other about how evolution works in biological systems. But nevertheless, I thought it was really interesting the way that Hillis presents genetic algorithms in this chapter. And I compared it to the way that Michael Behe, who's a professor at Lehigh, he's from Penn, but he's at Lehigh, who was one of the fellows of the Discovery Institute. They're sort of a creation science kind of institute. And so they're both interested in what about evolution and what about engineering? What about design, building things, and what about natural selection in the real world? And they have very different perspectives on it, but they had a remarkable amount of commonality as well. So I took a bunch of quotes from these two guys and I paired them up. So Danny Hillis, the guy who wrote the book, who is himself a designer, and Michael Behe, who is a biologist. So first of all, they both seem to think that you can recognize when something was designed. Behe says, if you look into a car's engine, you look in and it's so orderly, it's so arranged that you say, an intelligent agent must have designed this. And he's right, of course, because cars actually were designed by people. Then Hillis says, he's like, yeah, you can tell the difference between things that are designed and things that aren't designed. Just look inside a monkey's brain. It doesn't look like a computer. Things that are designed by evolution have a very different look to them than things that are designed by people. So I thought that was very interesting. He says that... there's in some sense not disagreeing. A car was in fact designed by people or an intelligent entity, and monkey brains, probably not. One of the reasons that these guys disagree, but Behe comes up with, they're both talking about the opposite side, right? Hillis is an expert on actual designed electronics and devices. Behe's an expert on biological things. So they're both talking about the other person's field in a sense. They weren't saying this to each other, right? You realize that I'm taking these quotes completely out of context and pairing them up because they're on similar topics. But nevertheless, Hillis would recognize a car as being designed as well. But Behe says that there are things at the cellular level that also seem to be designed. So I don't know what Hillis would say about that. What about natural selection? So both of them agree that there is natural selection. Behe says that what does he say? That natural selection can only choose among systems that are already working. So Behe says that natural selection is good for tuning things that already work. And what Hillis says is actually simulated evolution is a good thing for creating novel structures, something that's completely new. And actually it's a very bad way of tuning an existing design. So they actually seem to be flipped on this particular point, which seems to be a design and computational point, which I would tend to give to Hillis. They both agree that there is irreducible complexity. So one of Behe's arguments is that if a person were so unfortunate as to be missing one of the eye's many integrated features, then the inevitable result would be a severe loss of vision. Right? Eye is a very complicated thing. If you take away any of the proteins of it, you basically lose the value of the eye, which Behe then takes as, this is why it's so unlikely to have evolved, because how could it have evolved all those things in one shot? Hillis said more or less the same thing, that a bird, the nest building behavior requires lots of individual behaviors that all have to work together, and if any one of those is missing, then there's no advantage, no evolutionary advantage of it. Hillis takes that as an indication that, evolving really tough behaviors is really hard. Not that it's impossible, but it's just very, very it's slow. And in fact, in his simulations, it's often very, very slow. He needs all 65,000 of his processors working together sometimes to find good solutions. They disagree on whether we need to understand things. So Behe says that in order to say that some function is understood, every relevant step in the process must be elucidated. Hillis says that it's possible that if we actually were able to build a brain electronically, we wouldn't understand it. It doesn't mean that we didn't build it. It doesn't mean that we didn't make it. It just means that it's so complicated and it came about in this kind of bottom-up way that we can't really explain or reproduce that maybe we can not even understand things that we've made. But they also both like the other person's field better in some sense. So Behe says that the cilium of a microorganism, he says it can't be solved by natural selection. It has to have been that it was designed. And Hillis says that whenever you design something, it's too fragile. If you really want to make something that's robust, you have to do it with evolution. So both of them don't know how to solve the problem and assume that the other person can do it. So in some sense, the whole debate is actually a bit silly. But one of the things I think is really cool is that Hillis is an intelligent designer. Right? He's an intelligent guy who's designed things. He says that if he were in charge of creating the world, he would choose evolution as his design mechanism. So, so in some sense, you could summarize this as evolution, the choice of the intelligent designer. So, this is sort of irrelevant to the class in a lot of ways, but it just touched on some interesting subjects. The thing that was interesting The main thing to get out of the chapter, though, is that this is a mechanism that people are using to design software systems. And one of the reasons that that feels like a good idea of doing it this way is because you evaluate whole systems. And so you can't get these component mismatches that are going to cause a failure. You're always testing, how well does it really solve the problem? How well does it really solve the problem? And so as a methodology, it actually seems to make a lot of sense. Testing is really important when you're designing stuff. All right, so I think that's it. So we can't do the demo, but you got to see the robot. If you want to see the robot sometime, just let me know. My lab is still here. You guys are always welcome to come by and check it out. We have other stuff I can show you as well. But basically, that's it for the book. Next time, I'll be talking about the final. So please come with questions so I can help you.